Hey everybody, welcome to F This Movie. I hope you're pumped up. I know I am. My name is Patrick Bromley, and I'm joined tonight for a discussion of Pain and Gain by Adam Riske.
Would you like some of this breast milk?
I would love some of this breast milk.
Here you go.
Thank you very much. I put my HGH in there. Do you want to be pain or gain?
I will be gain.
Okay. I feel like if we were like a tag team, we'd have to each be one.
Well, P is for Patrick.
Oh, that makes sense.
Yeah. Patrick Payne Bromley.
That's me.
Adam Gain Risky. Wah, wah.
Remember, you can find our website at fthismovie.net. Like us on Facebook at facebook.com/fthismovie. Follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/fthismovie. Find us on DVD Verdict at dvdverdict.com. And find us in the iTunes store by searching for F This Movie, I guess. You could subscribe to us that way. And as always, you can email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com.
Yeah.
I did it. So we're going to be talking about pain.
Out of the way.
We're going to be talking about Pain and Gain. Michael Bay's, what, like his indie movie?
His low budget passion project.
Yes, that's really what this is.
His, or at least back end points project.
How this was sold to us. But before we talk about Pain and Gain, Adam, have you seen anything good lately?
Okay. I've seen two good ones.
All right.
I saw one that's not so good, so I want to get that out of the way. I want to rip it off like a Band-Aid.
You're going to talk about Pain and Gain already?
No.
Oh, sorry.
Pace yourself. Pace yourself, Pain. and I'm going to spell it P-A-Y-N-E.
Oh, nice.
Like Alan Payne.
Or, like, what if I, like, went up the ranks and I became, I don't know, not a sergeant, more of a, like a major.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Would you say that this is your house of pain?
I would consider saying this is a house of pain, and then I would say, am I my brother's keeper?
And that rhymes with Taylor Dane, not my am I my brother's keeper.
Who sings the anthem of the Hall of Kickass.
Yeah, yeah. I gotta reload this summer and meet some more celebs.
Get out there, man.
I know.
Press the flesh.
I'm trying. Ooh, that sounds gross.
Oh, it won't be.
Okay.
Once you're face-to-face with Sherilyn Fenn.
Yeah. Did you ever meet Sherilyn Fenn?
No, I saw her once.
Ooh.
She looked like a soccer mom who used to be on Twin Peaks.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. Awesome, awesome, awesome. All right, so the bad one, I was traveling for work, and I was in a lot of hotels this week, and I caught up with Identity Thief.
Oh.
And it's like watching cinema die in front of your eyes.
You know, that was, for a time, the highest grossing movie of the year.
It's still playing at the 30-screen movie theater.
Some people haven't caught up with it yet.
It's
like, oh, I've been so busy, but I wanted to see Identity Thief.
Mm-hmm. It's like, I want to avoid the crowds.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, finally.
Yeah, it's just dumb and lazy, and I turned it off after 45 minutes, and I turned it off right at the point where I hadn't laughed once yet.
Always good for a comedy.
Yes, very good for a comedy. They had Hitmen, which is always key to a comedy.
Absolutely.
And that wasn't good enough, so Robert Patrick showed up as like a dirty hobo skip tracker, which is like an identity thief bounty hunter, which I did not know needed their own movie.
Yeah.
But once I saw that, I was like, yeah, I think I'm going to be good with turning off Pain and Gain. So I turned it off, and it was so bad that I had to leave the room that was on.
Oh my gosh.
And, like, I just couldn't be in there anymore.
Bad mojo.
So don't watch it. Because I watched it.
What if it gets way better in the second half?
Then the joke's on me.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
What if it's all building towards the brilliance?
Oh, well, I don't know. I mean, like, I heard it is a little bit Wild Bunch in the end. So, it's just, you know, I don't know. So, watch it on Redbox.
Yeah.
Do it. So, that was really bad. Just avoid it. But the two that I saw that were good were, I finally caught up on a William Friedkin wave with To Live and Die in L.A.
Yes.
I had never seen it before this afternoon.
I love that movie.
I love it, too.
It's crazy. I mean, we can't talk about why it's crazy exactly.
Yeah.
But it does something that I've never seen a movie do. The first time I saw it was probably 15 or 20 years ago, and I was, like, rocked by what that movie does.
I saw it 15, 20 years after you, and I was still rocked by what it does. It's kind of a, I don't know, would you consider it underrated still?
I would, yeah, okay. Although I think it definitely has its fans now.
Yeah, it's just like a really idiosyncratic crime movie.
Yeah.
Like, they, I haven't seen one quite like that, and there's so many things that are kind of silly in it, but, like, that makes it better, almost.
Right.
Like,
right.
For example, Willem Dafoe's character, he hangs out a lot in, like, this Cirque du Soleil bar, which they never really explain, like, what it is. Like, his girlfriend's some kind of a performance artist, but it looks like a, just, like, a club when he walks in there, but they have some kind of, like, weird painted face shows as the attraction, which I thought was odd. I'll have to talk to you kind of after the podcast to avoid spoilers about the ending, because I wanted to talk to you about that, but, okay. Counterfeiting doesn't look like it's much fun.
No.
Like, it's almost like, okay, like, when Willem Dafoe is, like, actually counterfeiting and making the money,
which,
like,
is a cool sequence.
It's a great, great sequence, and there's, like, no music playing, and it's just, you really
just have like, time here's how to watch do this.
The
right.
process of it. And did you notice he doesn't make any dimes?
What?
Because he doesn't want anybody to drop them. Jeez. Anyway, so, but...
I could be remembering this wrong, but they might have had, like, actual Treasury people as consultants, like...
Yeah.
Telling them, like, you have to change certain steps, or, like, you can't do it exactly the way to do it, because we don't want to actually teach people how to do this.
But. Yeah, and I heard that, like, some of the bills actually went out into circulation for, and they took, it took a long time to get them back.
I want some of that fake Dafoe money.
I know, right? But it's like... All right, say you're working and stuff, just like you're at your job, just and you've got like a to-do list and you've got stuff that you're less looking forward to do.
Sure.
It seems like his job is like completely consisting of stuff that I would not be looking forward to do.
Yeah.
So it's just kind of like, is it worth it?
Yeah, but okay.
I don't know.
All right, but look at it this way. When you're done with work for the day, like where do you usually go?
I usually go home.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Where does he go?
He goes...
Cirque du Soleil Club.
He does go to Cirque du Soleil Club.
Crazy face painting, trapeze, sex.
And this was right in between, like, Streets of Fire and Platoon. That's like a crazy Dafoe run.
Yeah.
I mean, like, and he's just screaming ass, like, throughout, like, his whole career, especially in this movie. I mean, just, like, it's like nobody knows, like maybe his face looks different to me than to other people.
It's hard to believe. I mean, I guess Platoon is really the movie that turned it around, because how could anybody, like, Oliver Stone deserves some points, I guess, for seeing Streets of Fire and To Live and Die in L.A. and saying, like, he could play something other than a terrifying creep.
Yeah. I mean, he's solid. I really like him and stuff.
Yeah.
So.
Great car chase.
Great
car chase. I think they got sued by Michael Mann. For that movie.
Oh, yeah, because they said that it was too close to Miami Vice.
Right. But they won, I think, so
that means that it's not close to Miami Vice.
Yeah, right? I liked Killer Joe, but I think To Live and Die in L.A., which is now, you know, almost 30 years old.
85,
I think, yeah. I think that's his last, like, great movie.
What about The Hunted?
You know, I still haven't seen The Hunted. I've actually been trying to catch up on some Friedkin on Netflix Instant, and The Hunted is on there. So far, I've only seen Jailbreakers, his Rebel Highway entry. It's awful. And Blue Chips.
I've seen Blue Chips.
I didn't care for Blue Chips.
There's some funny Nick Nolte acting in Blue Chips.
It was like...
Get the hell out of here,
such a 90s movie. It was... Even the way it's lit, just like, oh, this definitely came out in the early, like, 93.
And didn't they play that, like, one song for, like, an hour straight where they're like, baby, please don't go!
But it's definitely Shaq's best acting outside of Kazam and Steel.
Yeah. I mean, like, he was good in Scary Movie 4, I thought.
I forgot him. He's in Scary Movie 4? I've seen Scary
with
Movie
Dr.
4.
Phil. They were in the Saw Trap, and he couldn't hit three
throws. Oh, I remember that.
And I remember I mildly chuckled at that, and then I felt like a horrible person for mildly chuckling. And then I thought, why am I in a theater for Scary Movie 4?
I think I saw that in the theater, too.
Yeah.
How weird.
I would watch The Hunted. I think it's kind of underrated.
Okay.
It got dismissed when it first came out, but it's not bad.
I'll check it out.
And the other thing I saw that was good was I saw Mud, the new Jeff Nichols joint. And I have seen Take Shelter and I've seen Mud. I think I like Take Shelter a little bit more than Mud. But the thing that's interesting about Mud is it's kind of like sold as a mystery.
Right.
And that's the least interesting part of the movie.
Okay.
And there's a lot more to it, and it's, I don't want to say, like, it's a coming-of-age story, because that's way overused, so right. I'm just going to say it's, like, a little boy learning stuff movie. So, as that, it has a lot to kind of say about what it's like to be in love and to what people in a relationship can do to each other through romantic relationships, like ending and continuing. And I wasn't expecting that out of the movie. So I thought that stuff was really kind of well observed and it had something interesting to say. So I would see it. I would start with Take Shelter first if you haven't seen any of the Jeff Nichols stuff. But Michael Shannon's in it for like 5 minutes. But his 5 minutes, once the movie's over, you're like, wow, that was pretty crucial to, like, the heart and soul of the movie.
Right.
It's not necessarily, like, the plot of the movie. So I would recommend it. It was good.
I still haven't seen Take Shelter, and I want to see Mud, although I have to admit the trailer loses me, like, first when Reese Witherspoon shows up.
Yeah.
But then also when the reveal is made that his name is Mud.
Yeah, that's one thing that I didn't really like about the movie, because there's a kid in the movie named Neckbone.
Yeesh.
And it's like when Jeff Nichols was writing the screenplay to this, it's like you would think that he had to type Neckbone a lot of times. And he would think
he never
that
did, like, find replace all.
Yeah, he could have been like, I'll call him Nick. Yeah, call him Nick. And
it's short for Neckbone.
Yeah. There's one sequence that's, like, really crazy. It's, like, the mud butt sequence.
What?
I'm just kidding.
Oh. Did you see...
There's no mud butt going on in Mud.
Did you see Premium Rush?
I did.
What did you think of Michael Shannon in that movie?
He was really funny.
Yeah, right?
I thought it was very entertaining.
I thought so. I mean, I didn't hate the movie. Yeah. I was sort of indifferent about the movie. But, like, Michael Shannon appears to be sort of in another way more entertaining movie. Like, he's the thing that makes that movie, I think, worth seeing.
Yeah, he always seems to be having fun, and, like, he kind of is wanting you to be in on the joke, but it's like, if you're not, then that's fine.
You
can just kind of enjoy
Michael
Shannon performance. I think he might be the best part of Bad Boys 2.
Oh my gosh.
I'm just kidding. He's not good in Bad
Who
Boys 2.
Who is he in Bad Boys 2? I remember, like, him from Pearl Harbor.
He was the redneck Klansman,
like, at the beginning.
That they capture later and, like, make fun of and stuff, which is fitting because he's a Klansman, so I don't care.
I remember sort of now. It's been a while since I've seen Bad Boys 2.
Yeah, he was kind of in Bay's pocket for a
little
while.
Yeah, what happened?
I don't know. He
Damn it.
Learned his lesson that he was good. And, he's like, and then Michael Bay was just like, hey, buddy, you want to be a pain again? He's just like, fuck you, man. Have you seen the...
I haven't watched it. The thing with the sorority
letter?
Oh, my God,
it's good.
I haven't watched it. Yeah,
the thing with the sorority letter was pretty solid.
I need to check it out. Yeah. I haven't yet.
So what have you been watching?
What have I seen? I watched on Netflix Instant to complete my Rob Zombie watching. I finally saw The Haunted World of El Superbeasto.
I watched 15 minutes of that.
I didn't mind it. I mean, it's like, it's one joke, sort of, the whole way through.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't know, it's Rob Zombie's sort of, like, anime. It's his, The Owls of Ga'Hoole. It's his animated movie.
It's his Cool World.
Yeah, right. It is definitely, like, Ralph Bakshi meets heavy metal meets Ren and Stimpy. Like, the one joke, basically, is that, like, there's sex and violence in this cartoon.
Were you kind of hooked when you saw, like, the little master of ceremonies guy at the beginning, and you're just like, ooh, this might be kind of cool.
Even the opening credits that look like a 1930s, like, Universal Monster movie.
What was the song they were playing? Because that was from a Universal Monster movie.
Don't know.
I can't remember either, but it was bugging me.
There's songs in the movie from Chris Hardwick and Mike Furman that are kind of funny, I thought.
Okay.
I kind of enjoyed it. It's super juvenile and, like, one joke, but it's real short, and there's always, like, goofy little references to other horror movies going on. And
yeah, they had, like, a Jack Nicholson Shining thing at the beginning, which I thought was, like, kind of... I laughed a few times just because I'm like, that's so weird.
Yeah.
Like, it wasn't even a joke. It was just, like, kind of odd that it was there.
He's, like, in a bar. There's, like, a bar where all these horror movie characters hang out, but it's never made explicit. I don't know, whatever.
Yeah.
So I saw that. I saw... I saw this crazy Canadian sort of exploitation movie called Rolling Vengeance from 1987. I don't even think it's on DVD. It's about this trucker whose, like, family is killed, of course, And so he decides to take revenge. Ned Beatty is, like, the only recognizable guy in the movie.
Is he the trucker?
He's not. He's, like, the bad guy. It's sort of like a roadhouse. Like, he'd be the town bad guy. But he wears, like, this pompadour the whole movie. Like, if you've never seen Ned Beatty in a pompadour, it is something. It's, like, this weird ducktail hairdo. And he makes this, like, tank, basically. It's not even, like, a semi. He makes this thing that shoots fire out the top. It looks directly out of the Road Warrior. And so you wait, like, almost an hour for him to finally make his Rolling Vengeance tank. And then he, like, runs over, like, four people, and then the movie's pretty much over.
Oh.
It was a big letdown.
It sounds like a letdown.
It was.
Yeah. It sounds like a fast-forward type movie. You get the setup, and then you go right to the end.
If I had known, I might have fast-forwarded. I mean, it's amusing in, like, a super 80s. I was watching it with my wife, and she said, "This is from 1987?" And I said, "Yeah." And she said, "It feels like 82. And I said, "Well, it's Canadian, so it's like our 1982.
Makes sense.
Just kidding, everyone in Canada.
They just got Spider-Man 3.
we're sorry. The other movie I'll mention is I watched on Netflix Instant, which I had never seen, Ride with the Devil.
Is that the Skeet Ulrich
movie? It is.
Okay.
The movie Ang Lee made between Ice Storm and Crouching Tiger.
Have you seen Life with Pi yet?
I still
have
not. I haven't seen Life with Pi or Life of Pi. Ang Lee.
But
I've seen Ride with the Devil. Ang Lee is like, I know he's a super talented director, right? But I don't. I'm never like, I gotta see the new Ang Lee. I've never said that in my life ever.
Yeah.
It's a crazy movie. Like, I kind of ended up liking it, even though it's a movie about the Civil War. It takes place in Missouri, but it's told, like, from the South's point of view. Like, these characters all fight for the Confederacy, but, like, you would never know it. Like, all the politics are... I don't understand what the point is of having them fight for the Confederacy, because the politics are never really explored in the movie, and Jeffrey Wright is in it as, like, a freed slave who's fighting with the Confederacy because his previous owner was, like, cool to him. It's
that happened.
I guess. Yeah. Just the politics don't make sense, but...
To them, it was just life with pie.
It's well acted. It's very well shot. The music is good. Jewel acts in it.
Like acts or like tries to act?
She's fine. Okay. She's not like, what? I was never like, oh man, Jewel should have acted more, but she's fine.
What do you, all right, I gotta ask you about like the, since Tobey Maguire's in it.
Yeah, he is.
I don't think that he's got anything left in his tank.
Nowadays, we'll find out when Gatsby drops.
I feel like he can only play like one type of guy.
Kind of, yeah. And I don't know if he was the right guy for Ride with the Devil. I like him in Pleasantville.
Okay.
I think he's really good in that.
Yeah, I still remember his eyes bulging out of his head and foaming at the mouth in Brothers.
Oh, I forgot about Brothers. Yeah. I didn't like that movie.
Acting!
One fun thing about Ride with the Devil is it was made in 99, and everybody in it has sort of gone on to be somebody, like Simon Baker, the Mentalist, shows up, and Jim Caviezel, and Jonathan Brandis is in it, pre-suicide Jonathan Brandis.
That's sad.
Mark Ruffalo shows up.
Yeah.
Skeet, obviously. This was right in the heart of America's love affair with Skeet Ulrich.
Pre-Chill Factor? Chill Factor was, it was like 98.
Was it 98?
98 or 99.
I would have guessed. I think it was like January 99, so this was actually post-Chill Factor.
Okay.
I
think you're Chill thinking Factor of January 99, because maybe that was when he was in Playgirl?
Was he in Playgirl?
No, I'm just kidding. I would be okay with a Skeet Ulrich comeback. He kind of did like a Armored thing.
That's right, I forgot about Armored.
Yeah, and he was like trying to just be like, yeah, I'm Skeet Ulrich, I'm just here to do my job.
Sorry about the Johnny Depp thing, everybody, it's not my fault.
It's not.
He was on that show that people really liked.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
It starts with a J.
Jericho?
Jericho. Yeah. There it is. Mm-hmm. Boom. Did you ever see Touch, the Paul Schrader movie?
No, I have not.
It's interesting. It's worth checking out.
Okay. Is that a newer Paul Schrader movie?
No. This would have been, like, 97.
Okay.
It's an Elmore Leonard adaptation. It's Skeet Ulrich and Bridget Fonda and Tom Arnold and Janine Garofalo, Gina Gershon. A bunch of people are in it.
But I started watching Blue Collar on Netflix by Paul Schrader.
I've never seen Blue Collar, but I won a t-shirt at Planet Hollywood or Ed DeBevick's, one of those places, because I got that answer to a trivia question right. Like, I knew it existed.
Did you get a blue collar t-shirt?
No, sadly. I believe it was just Planet Hollywood Chicago.
Oh, I thought it was like the manager of Ed DeBevick's just was hanging onto this t-shirt from the 70s. And he's like, yeah, ask a trivia question.
I went to like a radio station sponsored sneak preview of High Fidelity in Milwaukee. And they were doing giveaways beforehand. They're like, okay, ready? All right, here's our question. Who's the director of this movie? And I was literally the only hand that went up. And I said, Stephen Frears. And they're like, I don't know. Is that right? Like, they didn't even know. So I won the t-shirt, everyone.
Nice.
That story has a happy ending.
All right, Payne. I got a trivia question
for you. Let's hear it. I'm probably not going to know it, but I can edit this to make it sound like I do.
I mentioned Mud.
Yeah.
I mentioned To Live and Die in L.A.
All right.
And we're going to be talking about Pain and Gain. All right. What do those three movies have in common?
Wow.
You don't have to answer right now. We could wait. We could come back to it.
Okay. I can't think of a connection.
I'll give you another hint.
Right now.
Who's the boss?
I mean, Tony Danza, right?
Keep going. Judith down the Light? Train. Do you want me to just tell you?
Yeah.
Three movies from people who were in the movie Fear.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and I saw them all. That's like impressive. It was weird. You can cut that part out.
Who? Wait. Oh, William Peterson.
He shot puts Mark Wahlberg out of a window.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh.
It's great.
That movie is not good.
It's about romance.
I remember when they were advertising it, and it was like, featuring the song Machine Head by Bush. And I couldn't figure out who's going to see that movie to hear that song. Like,
yeah.
It's all over the radio. You can buy it in a store. Who's like, I gotta get my Machine Head fix. One for Fear, please. Yeah.
I need to hear it in a theater with the Dolby right, sound.
Right.
It's actually still all over the radio if you have XM Lithium.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's every fourth song is a Bush song.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
All right, let's talk about Pain and Gain.
Let's do it.
This is, like we said earlier, Michael Bay's sort of smaller movie. He took a break from making Transformers movies. He made Transformers 1, 2, 3. He's going to make Part 4, but in between, he graced us with his, like, $30 million character piece called Pain and Gain, based on a true story of a horrible, horrible crime. We're going to talk, I would say spoiler-free, but, I mean, the story is out there, so I don't know. Yeah.
Did you read the articles?
I did, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I read a summary of the articles.
Super crazy and interesting. So, I mean, I guess we could sort of try and talk around certain things for a little while. We'll spoil it more towards the end, but the story is out there, so we wouldn't actually be spoiling anything in the movie because it does stick very close to the true events. Mm-hmm. So I guess every once in a while we'll say spoiler for real-life events. I'm interested in this movie because it seems to be getting not just a pass, mm-hmm. but, like, praised in a lot of critical circles.
Yeah.
What did you think of Pain and Gain?
Well, I think the most interesting thing to kind of consider about Pain and Gain is Michael Bay in on the joke?
Okay.
That's kind of it for me, because I have a complicated relationship with Michael Bay's movies.
Yes.
I don't... There's certain ones that I just hate outright and always have disliked, and mainly the Transformers trilogy and everything. But when I'm in the moment watching, say, Bad Boys for the first time, or The Rock, or Armageddon, or The Island, I'm having an okay time with them. It's like eating McDonald's. You're good with it while it's happening, but then when you give it any thought whatsoever, and like when you think about maybe that you liked it, you feel really bad afterwards.
Right.
And I felt the same way about Pain and Gain.
Okay.
So I was really having a lot of trouble with the Bayness of the movie, because he's still got, even on a smaller scale, a lot of his excess.
Yeah.
But I'm a really big Mark Wahlberg fan.
Okay.
I really like Dwayne Johnson, even though I feel like he's never in movies that suit his talent level.
Sure.
And I think Anthony Mackie is kind of underrated. So, like, the fact that the three of them kind of survive all of the horrible Bay idiosyncrasies made it enough for me to enjoy a lot of it, especially in the first act of the movie.
Okay.
Yeah.
Michael Bay is a fascinating guy because, you know, in sort of movie fan circles, and I'm talking more about sort of like certain websites and sites like ours, or just, you know, communities where people like talking about movies. He is the go-to guy for, like, who's a horrible director, who's a hack. Everybody says, oh, Michael Bay. Michael Bay's the worst. And yet, we all go see all of his movies. Like, and everyone does. It's not just us. It's like, people can't resist going to a Michael Bay movie, even though, like, he's almost always let us down.
Yeah. It's. I was thinking about that, too, and I think a lot of it has to do with his movies look really good. Yeah. Not like they look good like they're going to be quality movies, but just visually, it's pleasing to look at.
Yeah.
He shoots them really well. He's a good technician.
Right. Well, yeah, because, okay, Devin Faraci liked this movie and went on this rant about how Michael Bay's a great filmmaker. And it's interesting because people are liking Pain and Gain, and now all of a sudden they're sort of retconning his entire career where it's like, Michael Bay's a great filmmaker.
Yeah.
And I don't know when this happened, but okay, so if the argument is he's a great filmmaker because he can compose a shot, because they work technically, is that what we mean when we say, like, he's a great filmmaker? Because as a storyteller, he's garbage.
Yeah,
like,
he's a terrible storyteller. I think what I mean, and I don't think that I defend it as much as maybe a Devin Faraci does.
Yeah, you were not saying he's a great filmmaker.
But what I'm saying is it just is aesthetically pleasing to look at from like a ape id level.
It's super colorful. It's super incredibly slick.
It's like, very slick. It's very colorful. He learned a lot from the whole Jerry Bruckheimer relationship, and he's carried that over. I think that it's funny because Michael Bay is actually one of those directors where if you watch Bad Boys or The Rock, there's still certain elements of, like, what will become known as what a Michael Bay movie is defined by.
Yeah.
But there's less of that.
Definitely.
And it's almost as if he's a director who we want to be mute. Like, we don't want him to have a voice. Because if he just played an action movie straight without any type of of his own individual personality and opinion, and he just shot it, like, maybe he would be, like, a really good cinematographer.
Sure.
But, like, he had, like, a good script and good actors, then maybe he could make a good movie. But that's a lot of fucking elements that he doesn't have that we're supposed to just give him a pass
on. Well, and I think this was, like, his shot at that. Yeah. Like, this was the movie that was going to redeem him. And I think with a lot of people, it has. Like, I don't deny that he has a talent and, like, knows what he's doing. Because even all the way back to, like, Bad Boys, that movie was made for, like, maybe $20 million, maybe less. And he makes it look like $100 million. I mean, he's...
Yeah. And he does that with Pain and Gain, I think, too.
Yeah. I mean, he knows what he's doing.
Yeah.
It's just that I can't stand what he's doing. And I, like you, have gone to see, I think, all of them. I think the only one I skipped was Transformers Revenge of the Fallen, which I saw eventually, and it's, like, the worst movie. Mm-hmm. Up until, I thought Dark of the Moon had a few things that, like, okay, that's not the worst. Prior to Dark of the Moon, I thought every movie he made was his newest worst movie, that they always got worse.
Okay.
I think Dark of the Moon was a step up from Revenge of the Fallen. I think Pain and Gain is maybe a step up from Dark of the Moon, so maybe we're watching the pendulum swing back up now. I don't know. It's going to take him another 8 movies to get back to the quality of Bad Boys. Like, that's where the bar is, apparently.
Well, his first... his next movie is Transformers 4.
Right.
So
that's right. The pendulum's going back the other way.
And also, this movie, it's supposed to... I looked at, like, the box office tracking so far. It's going to be the number one movie this weekend, but it's only going to make, like, $20 million, which means that it'll probably finish with about 40 or 50 once Iron Man takes away all the money.
Yeah, right.
So what that means is he's going to need another hit, and he's going to go play it safe all over again, and he's going to go back to Transformers 4 or something that's even safer, if you can think of something like that.
Yeah.
Next. This was a little blip. It's not going to mean anything.
Right.
Yeah.
And this was the first movie of his that I was genuinely sort of interested in in years, because, okay, he is trying to do something different. I want to see him work on a smaller budget. I want to see him tell a story that isn't just this sort of blockbuster machine with a cup and a big summer release date. Like, okay, great. I'm on board. And it seemed to me from the early trailers that I thought this was going to be an example of, like 6 months ago, maybe a year ago, I don't know. I wrote a thing about True Romance, and I talked about how people complain that Quentin Tarantino didn't direct True Romance. And my argument has always been, no, it's great that Tony Scott did, because Tony Scott's aesthetic is like this weird representation of how those characters see the world. Mm-hmm. And I like the way that that matches up. And so when I saw early trailers for Pain and Gain, I thought that's what it was going to be. That, like, these guys want to live life in a Michael Bay movie, so his aesthetic is finally going to comment on the material instead of just dressing it up.
Yeah.
And I don't think that that's the case.
I think to that point, what he has done is shown us that he is those guys.
Yeah.
He, like, because that's why I asked you, you know, is he in on the joke or not?
Right.
There's a lot of really, like, cutesy bullshit stuff that happens in the movie that really bothered me, where it's like,
yeah,
like 2 hour or like an hour 45 into it, there's like a line on the screen in text that says, "This is still a true story." And it's just like, oh God, did you really just put that on there? And it's almost put there just so, it's like him saying, no, I'm in on the joke. This isn't like how I am. I think these people are really stupid. But then everything that you saw up to that point is evidence that he's probably just as dumb as these guys are, kind of.
Well, here's the problem with Michael Bay to me, is I don't think he's dumb. But I think he thinks his entire audience is really dumb. And that's what bothers me so much about him, is that his movies are made like, here you go, assholes, you'll like this, mm-hmm. instead of like, I want to make the best possible movie. I don't think he ever tries to make the best possible movie.
Yeah.
I think he tries to make this thing that panders to the audience that he believes are just mouth-breathing morons.
Mm-hmm.
I
hate saying this, but like, as evidence of the people who I sat and watched Pain and Gain with in that theater, he's doing exactly what it's fish in a barrel.
With most of his movies, his success has meted out that approach. I mean, look at Transformers. It's like, wow, these are horrible movies, and they make crazy amounts of money. The Island was a movie that I was sort of excited about because it looked like he was trying to do something different, and he did. I mean, I don't think that movie works because it's maybe an hour too long and derivative and blah, blah, blah.
Car chases. I'll give it that.
But it's the car chase from Bad Boys 2. Like, he kind of repeated the car chase where they're just dropped.
But it's such a good car chase.
The car chase from Bad Boys 2.
It's incredible.
Amazing. There's some stuff in Bad Boys 2 that...
Yeah, and I mean, like, I don't like Haitians either. I'm just kidding.
But that movie, it seemed like he was trying to stretch himself, and at least now he kind of does again. So, yeah, I mean, his success continues to justify this approach. Like, I wanted to like Pain and Gain, or I at least went into it very open-minded and very optimistic. Like, okay, this is going to be the Michael Bay movie that I kind of like. And I ended up feeling about it the way I feel about almost every Michael Bay movie, which is that it's really stupid, that it's at least an hour too long.
Yeah, it did feel really long.
And that it's, I mean, every one of his movies is like 2.5 hours, and there's just no justification for that whatsoever.
Yeah.
My biggest problem, though, is that it's so ugly. Michael Bay is often accused of, like, having no soul because his movies are so slick and kind of empty. I don't believe that Michael Bay doesn't have a soul. I think Michael Bay is... I won't say that he's evil, but I think he has such a black, black view of the world. I think... If you look at this movie, and again, this is a movie that a lot of people are saying no, because that's what this movie is about. It's about sort of this moral corruption, and so the movie's just reflecting that. But again, I think a lot of people have made movies about people who are morally bankrupt without including so much cheap ugliness.
Well, look at Spring Breakers to prove your point. That I was thinking of that movie actually during Pain and Gain at certain points, because these guys aren't that far off from just the nihilism and just complete lack of humanity as the girls and James Franco in that movie.
Right.
But it seems like, whereas Harmony Korine has an opinion about it and is kind of looking at it from a you know, let's consider this perspective, Michael Bay and his style and his point of view, because he's got, like, that one scene with, like, the where they're buying guns, and of course he has to throw in, like, the kind of feminine, like, Christian guy who loves, like, machine guns and stuff like that. I mean, like, he's as bad as the things that he's attempting to mock. Or he's reveling in them.
There's two kinds of people in the world of a Michael Bay movie. I mean, yeah. I saw this movie. I ran into JB at the theater, and he was going to see something else, and I accidentally talked him into seeing Pain and Gain. And I was after the movie. I said, "There's two kinds of people in Michael Bay movies," and he said, "Michael Bay and everyone else." And that's actually a more accurate point. Mm-hmm. The point I was going to make is there are two kinds of people. There are the beautiful people, which are the sort of steroid Mark Wahlberg, Dwayne Johnson, like mm-hmm. these huge, buff, great-looking movie stars, and conversely, the surgically enhanced Victoria's Secret model strippers. Like, there's one kind of woman in a Michael Bay movie, and she exists to be sexualized. It is the most disturbing thing.
Yeah.
Anybody who isn't those people is, like, grotesque. Like, they can't just be normal. They have to be covered in acne or have food stains all over their clothes or be this gross caricature of, like, a possibly, like you said, this effeminate Christian guy. Like, everyone exists mm-hmm. to be mocked.
Yeah, or, like, you had, like, Rebel Wilson can't play a character. She has to play, you know, like, the worst stereotype of a girl who's, like, turned on by big penises and stuff.
Right,
and,
so
like,
she's this walking fat joke who's also a delivery for, like, racist humor. Yeah. And I guess we're supposed to be laughing?
It's so strange. And also, Ken Jeong's role in it, he's, like, one of those Tony Robbins-type guys, but he's kind of more of, like, it's like an idiot's interpretation of, like, Tom Cruise in Magnolia.
Right.
So he even has, like, this one part where he talks about how he got rid of his, like, loving wife and children so he could have, like, just 7 Victoria's Secret models. And, like, it's a big joke. And then they even show, like, in the crowd, there's a kid sitting next to Mark Wahlberg who's grossly overweight and just, like, hooping it up and stuff. And I think that's, like, what he thinks the audience is.
Right. Everyone else is pathetic.
Yeah. It's...
It's completely disturbing. There's a scene about halfway through where there's a woman who sells Anthony Mackie a house, and Ed Harris, who's playing the private, I guess. And I liked Ed Harris. I mean,
yeah, he's in a different movie, but
and thank God, because he comes in. It's like, oh, finally a human being. Like, thank goodness. He says, you know, he paid $100,000 in cash for the house, and Ed Harris says, oh, that didn't raise any flags for you? And she says, well, no, I just assumed he was an athlete or a rapper. I mean, he is black. And it's like, okay, I guess we're supposed to be laughing because she's a racist. But there's a certain kind of person that could get away with that joke where we're laughing not at the racist joke, but at the idea of racism. But this movie doesn't achieve that level. So we're just supposed to be laughing at the racist joke. And Michael Bay thinks we're so stupid that he can't just have the throwaway, like, well, I thought he was an athlete or a rapper. And then we would say, like, oh my gosh, what a racist. And we would put that together in our heads.
Yeah.
But she has to go a step further and say, I mean, he was black. Get it? I'm a racist. And so is everyone in a Michael Bay movie.
Yeah. Before we kind of get off of Michael Bay too much, but...
We never will.
I know. But there's some stuff in the movie that I kind of appreciate more performance-wise, so I want to talk about that.
Sure.
But have you ever read a book called Watching Movies? It's written by Rick Layman.
No.
L-E-Y-M-A-N. But you should check out Michael Bay Watching West Side Story.
I own this book, and I haven't read his chapter.
If you read that chapter, you will get, in a nutshell, everything you will ever need to know about Michael Bay, which it's fascinating because this is right when he was doing post-production on Pearl Harbor.
Okay.
So he chose West Side Story, and it's really kind of interesting because the woman who's interviewing him and watching the movie with him, she says, you know, a lot of people asked me, you know, when I told them I was going to sit with Michael Bay to watch a movie, they said, well, what movie are you going to watch with him? And I said, he said he wanted to watch West Side Story. And they were all like, oh, well, that seems cynical. Like, why, like, he's doing it just to prove a point that he's not, like, the action misogynist guy.
Okay.
And I'm just like, okay, well, maybe he just likes West Side Story. Right. I don't know. So she sits down to watch the movie with him, and the first thing he says to her is, I picked this because people won't believe that I picked this.
Oh, God.
And then he goes into why he... Well, stuff he likes and doesn't like in the movie. And the stuff that he likes is all, look at how they cut this, and look at how they, you know, did this with color, and I really like how they used blue here and everything like that. And then anytime something goes on with the actual crux of West Side Story, the heart of the movie, when he sees, like, the guys dancing, he's just like, well, that's weird. And that's his only, like, statement, really, on it, is he's like, you eventually buy into it, but then you're just kind of like, well, that's weird. And he doesn't like the romance in the movie. He doesn't like the performances. And there's one performance in the movie, it's, like, the lead guy who plays Tony. It's not, like, a daring opinion to say that he's not very good in the movie. He isn't very good in the movie. But Michael Bay raises a very interesting point about Tony in that movie, or the actor who plays him, which is, I think, Richard Brammer. I can't remember exactly. But he said, the problem with that, and he's spot on with this, is you would never believe he's the leader of a gang, because he's a pussy, basically.
Right, right.
So, Michael Bay said, you know, when I was making Pearl Harbor, Disney brought me all of these really good actors who wanted to be in Pearl Harbor. And I said, no. Because they're not guys, and I'm only interested in guys. Because you have to, because guys watching action movies want to see guys, and they don't want to see anything other than that. So that's very, very revealing. He likes he cares very much about the technique. He doesn't give a shit about the story,
well, the fact that
or
he...
about anything other than his worldview.
Don't characterize your Pearl Harbor movie as an action movie. Yeah. Like, it's a tragedy. Like,
no, it's a guy's
movie. Yeah, right? Like, yeah. There's the first problem.
And also, is Josh Hartnett that much of a guy's
right?
guy?
Right, finally, yeah. Mr. Macho. Yeah. I believe Ben Affleck's character was named Rafe in that movie, so, you know, guy's name, Rafe.
Rafe.
I don't want to keep, like, putting Michael Bay into this box, like you had said, like, maybe he just likes West Side Story. Let's hear him out, you know?
But
like,
but
Michael Bay keeps
ever.
Putting himself in this box. And so every time I go into a movie, Pain and Gain, I'm like, good, I'm going to see him do something different. And he's like, no, here's me again, just telling a story that isn't necessarily an action movie. Not to bring up Devin Faraci again, but he had said, either in his review or in this video piece, he talks about Pain and Gain, and he says it's obvious that Michael Bay is a huge Coen Brothers fan. He's been on record as saying such. He's constantly using people from Coen Brothers movies in his movies. John Turturro and Francis McDormand, and Tony Shalhoub shows up in Pain and Gain.
Playing Joe Pesci.
Yeah, right. But he's clearly, with Pain and Gain, trying to make a Coen Brothers movie, but he has no idea how to do it.
Yeah.
And I think there's definitely some truth to that. And listen, black comedy is hard to pull off. It is. Mm-hmm. There are very few good ones. In this week's Netflix's movie, you recommended Heathers. I mean, that's a great black comedy. But it's tonally, it's a hard thing to pull off. Mm-hmm. I don't think he pulls it off with this movie. And part of what's missing is, partially maybe because this is based on real events, and I won't compare it to Fargo, even though he clearly is trying to make Fargo, but one of the things that makes Fargo so great is that there's an understanding, even when it's being kind of ironic or funny or, you know, black comedy, that this is all really sad.
Yep.
And that never registers in any of Pain and Gain. I mean, people's lives are ruined, people die, horrible, horrible things happen. Mm-hmm. And sort of spoilers for real life events, even when we get to the end on the witness stand, it's dick jokes. It's like, people are dead.
Mm-hmm.
People are going to death row. Lives are shattered.
Mm-hmm.
Dick jokes from a fat girl.
Well, it's also in that very same scene, this is a spoiler too, but real life events again. They give Anthony Mackie's character the death penalty, and he's got this face like, oh, geez, no.
Yeah.
And it's, like, so arch and cartoonish
right.
that that would never happen in a million years. And like you said, it's such a sad story.
Right.
That, okay, when you brought up the Fargo thing, like, I keep reading this bullshit, too, that it's like a Coen Brothers movie. And I'm really, like, offended by that. And I'll put it this way. You like the Coen Brothers probably a dozen times more than I do. I am very hot and cold on the Coen Brothers.
Yeah.
But he's so far off from making a Fargo here. He's not even, like, within a mile of making a Very Bad Things.
Yeah, right. That's way closer to what this movie is, I think. And I kind of like Very Bad Things, because at least Very Bad Things has Christian Slater's crazy performance.
Yeah.
Although we'll get to a few things that are...
Christian Slater's the best.
By the way, on your recommendation from, I think, the Evil Dead podcast, Bed of Roses was on, like, an HBO.
Yes, you watched Bed of Roses.
And I rewatched it. That movie's insane.
Yeah, it's so good.
It's so weird. I meant to bring that up in our What Have You Been Watching, because I wanted to talk about what happened to, like... the romance movie.
Yeah.
It doesn't exist anymore. It's a romantic comedy, or if it's a straightforward romance, it has to have Nicholas Sparks attached to it.
Well, spoilers for the thing that I'm writing for this week, but part of a bigger piece, but I mentioned Before Midnight in there. And that's another movie. It's like Before Midnight is just straight up romance.
Right, yeah, that's true.
So, yeah, but they're so few and far between.
Yeah, they used to come out.
Yeah.
Bed of Roses, come back to us. Anyway, back to Michael Bay. The only thing that I could take away from this movie is, like, in a way, the movie itself is a metaphor for, like, Michael Bay's whole career, in that, you know, it's all about sort of this pursuit of the American dream, but it's, like, rotten inside, and that's sort of... Michael Bay, he plasters, like, surfaces and American flags everywhere in all of his movies, but they're just black and evil inside. And I know he does it in this movie knowingly. I mean, every time we see a flag, and boy, there's a lot of in this movie, it's him saying, get it, this is, you know, this I'm being ironic, America. Like, ha ha ha, because basically Mark Wahlberg's only line of dialogue is, like, I want a chance to be more than I am. This is America. I deserve this.
I'm a doer, not a donor.
I mean, over and over and over again. And I like Mark Wahlberg in The Right Movie. I found his performance very one note in this movie.
Okay.
Very one note. I liked Anthony Mackie more because he kind of has a little arc, and you sort of are almost sympathetic towards him because when he gets opportunity, even though he did horrible things to achieve it, he just wants to, like, play house and, like, get married and be a normal guy.
One thing that was kind of weird about that was just they want to take all of Tony Shalhoub's possessions, and they want to make sure that he's got no livelihood to fall back on afterwards. But their goal to what to do with that stuff is very kind of limited, and maybe that's the point because they're so dumb.
Right.
But, yeah, I mean, like, Anthony Mackie, I think, is... maybe the most sympathetic of the three guys because he's so clearly just an idiot.
Right.
And, like, he's just going along. Like, he would never do this on his own.
Right.
But he's so clearly going along with it. And, like, you know, but Mark Wahlberg, like, they keep making reference to the fact that him and, like, the stripper were, you know, fucking and stuff like that. But, you know, with the exception of, like, one little, like, cut joke to that, you would think he's almost, like, asexual.
I thought that was really interesting, actually.
I thought it was weird, because he wants to play house, too. He wants to be, like, the neighborhood
respected
guy. It's weird, but, like, that doesn't seem like something that this guy would want.
Well, and I went into it expecting crazy amounts of debauchery, because, every Michael Bay trailer just looks like a Victoria's Secret model. There's always cutaways to, like, strip clubs and thongs and stuff. And there's some of that in this movie, although way less, like, sort of nudity than I was expecting. Mm-hmm. I thought once they got rich, it was just going to be, like, crazy. I almost kind of like that, this idea that, like, it has nothing... It's set up that he wants to make money to get women because he's lusting after the girl in the gym, and then he wants the stripper. But then as soon as they get rich, that all goes away.
Yeah, it's... doesn't
and I kind of like that he wants money for other reasons, but again,
like
if you're
a riding mower,
right, which is very weird. But if you watch, or not if you watch, if you read the story, I mean, the guy, is that real, what happened? Daniel Lugo, yeah. No. I mean, he was, like, constantly finding somebody new and dating them. He was married, then he got married again, then while he was married, he started dating the stripper, so he had his wife at home and then the stripper on the side. I mean, it was very much about getting women, so why change that, but then keep saying, this is a true story, this is still a true story. Here's something weird, too, and then we'll get back to Dwayne Johnson, who I think we both should talk about.
Oh, certainly, yeah.
This was the first time, because Michael Bay, you had said, he really sort of developed that Simpson-Bruckheimer style. I mean, Tony Scott kind of did it, and then Michael Bay took it off into the stratosphere. Mm-hmm. And it's very obvious the way that he's been influential. He sort of designed an aesthetic for an entire kind of movie, and Simon West rips it off, and Dominic Cena rips it off. And
Dominic Cena perfected it.
This was the first time where I felt like Michael Bay was sort of stealing from people that perhaps he had influenced. I saw a lot of Zack Snyder in the movie.
Okay.
More than just the speed ramping, although there's a ton of it. And a lot of Neville Dean Taylor. I felt like he ripped a lot he ripped off Crank a lot,
That's crazy.
In some of the photography.
Okay. Yeah, I could see that. Because there's some handheld type stuff. Is that what you're referring
to? I mean, I wonder if, like, Neville Dean Taylor... I can't figure out if they would have been better suited for this material. Their movies are so hateful too.
Yeah,
but like,
you're
they're so juvenile.
You're much more on Team Neville Dean Taylor than I am.
I am. Anyway, so let's go back to Dwayne Johnson.
Okay, before we could get to Dwayne Johnson, because you already mentioned like what you thought with Mark Wahlberg being one note. I'm a really big fan of Mark Wahlberg because, in the right role, he's incredible. He's really, really good.
It so rarely happens, though.
I think he's excellent at modulating levels of stupid.
Okay.
Because, and I think that's his wheelhouse. Like, his character in Ted is a dumb guy.
Right.
His character in The Departed is not really a dumb guy, but he's kind of like an hysterical male.
Sure.
And then, like, the other guys, he's kind of a nitwit. You've got, he's dumb in this. But it's always, it seems different.
Yeah.
It seems like a different kind of shade of dumb.
My issue with this performance is, and it's, this comparison has been made a lot, that he's basically, for the entire movie, playing the last hour of Boogie Nights, when he's all coked up in the 80s. And, like, he's basically doing that for the whole movie.
Yeah.
And the difference is, I think, when Boogie Nights came along, and I can watch that movie a million times, and every single time marvel at how good Mark Wahlberg is in that movie. Like, it's amazing to me. And to me, Boogie Nights is almost a performance that's genius by accident. That, like, he's not even aware of some of the things that he's doing that are so good in that movie. But it's now almost, it's not 20 years later, but it's 14 years later, something like that. And he's had a very successful career, and I think now I saw him making choices to play stupid, whereas in Boogie Nights, it just seemed like it was happening by accident, or like that he really was that guy.
Yeah, I can see like why the link would happen with the Boogie Nights character and with his character in Pain and Gain, but I almost think that his character in Boogie Nights is not... mean-spirited is the wrong phrase, but, like, he's not an evil guy.
Right.
Whereas the guy in Pain and Gain is stupid and evil.
Yeah.
So it's, that's, I guess, the kind of thing is just, I feel like he is kind of making choices still.
Sure.
Where, I don't know, but I mean, like, yeah, I agree with you about that Boogie Nights performance. There's just something, and it goes that way with, I think, a lot of actors kind of early in their career. They're still kind of figuring out what in their toolkit, oh god, I sound like a fucking acting teacher. What in their toolkit is you know, works better for them than works less for them.
Right.
And he's still trying to kind of find his way, and there's some kind of like a sweetness and like the naivete of that approach.
Yeah.
This is the most in-depth conversation I think anyone's ever given to the acting styling of Mark Wahlberg.
There's a moment, and I think Katie Rich or somebody at Cinema Blend wrote a whole piece about how the genius of Pain and Gain is in the way that it uses its stars and comments on their stardom. And she pointed this scene out, and when I saw it, I was like, okay, that's almost a thing. Like, it seems like Michael Bay had an idea with some intent. Let's say we're kind of in spoilers for Pain and Gain now. So yeah. If you are going to see it and you haven't read the stories and you don't want to know what happens, I guess tune out. But this requires some spoilers.
Actor's Toolbox.
When that's the new name for the podcast, by the way. Welcome to the Actor's Toolbox. Late in the movie, some murders occur. And they're going to hack up the bodies to get rid of the evidence. And they strip down. And Mark Wahlberg strips down and he's very prominently wearing sort of those tidy whitey, Calvin Klein, like boxer briefs, sort of.
Okay.
That were the underwear that sort of made him famous. He was a model for these Calvin Klein underwear very early on. And I don't know. I mean, Katie Rich goes further. She talks about The Rock grilling something, and you can literally smell what The Rock is cooking.
Is she room 237-ing
it? It might not be Katie Rich. It's somebody at Cinema Blend. I apologize if it's not Katie Rich, who I don't believe listens to this podcast, but I'm sorry if I'm misidentifying. But it's somebody at Cinema Blend. Maybe, possibly room 237-ing it. Yeah. When I saw that shot, because I think The Rock, smelling what The Rock is cooking, I think that's a stretch. But I thought the Calvin Klein thing did seem done with some intent. And the fact that he's stripping down to hack up bodies, I thought was sort of an ironic joke about, like, look at, in the way that Spring Breakers uses Selena Gomez or whatever, like, look what I'm doing with this image.
It could be, but I didn't notice it at all.
Okay.
Maybe
I wouldn't have had I not read the piece.
Maybe. I don't know. But the thing that I find interesting is if that were a direct reference to his career as an underwear model, whose idea was that?
Right.
Because do you think it's like, because the screenwriters who wrote this, they were responsible for like the Narnia movies and they did like Captain America. But
I liked Captain America.
I like Captain America too, but and the script was good, I guess, for that.
For Captain America?
Yeah.
Yeah, there was good dialogue.
So, I mean, like, for a touch like that, is that, like, a script thing? Is that, like, a Mark Wahlberg choice? Or is that, like, a Michael
Bay choice? To me, that seems like a Michael Bay choice to me. That, to him, is, like, the height of a clever in-joke.
Could be.
Because most of the comedy in the movie, and again, this is one of the big problems with Michael Bay. This has always been my biggest problem with Michael Bay, is that a lot of his movies have a lot of humor, and I'm saying that in aggressive air quotes, but he's utterly tone deaf for what humor is, and the humor in his movies is never even close to being funny. And so here you have a movie that's a black comedy basically that is never close to being funny. A lot of jokes, a lot of like ha ha ha, let's laugh at the fat people, or let's laugh at the racist jokes, or let's laugh at this, but never close to being funny.
Yeah, that's his cardinal sin as a filmmaker. He really thinks that he gets comedy.
Yes.
And comedy is as subjective as anything can be. What makes you laugh is different from you to me to anybody else. But I'm pretty damn sure that Michael Bay is not funny. He thinks that he is like Red Buttons or something.
I don't like the Transformers movies. And I'm not saying they would be good without all the comedy, but like take that away and they are way better.
Yeah.
Way better.
I don't think that he's doing this on purpose, but I think his career also has kind of become like, you know, you mentioned you made like a brilliant observation once.
Good job, me.
Nice job, Toolkit.
please call me Payne.
Sorry, Payne. You can call me Toolkit. that Will Ferrell movies are comedies about hysterical masculinity.
Yeah.
I think Michael Bay movies are about hysterical masculinity, but he's not in on the joke.
Yeah, maybe.
Because even like if you watch, like in the fucking Transformers movies, like Shia LaBeouf should be committed, like how amped up and nuts he is in those.
Yeah. I Michael Bay thinks something very specific entertains audiences. And once again, I guess he's right because they make a ton of money, but the pitch of his movies is like, relax, bring it down, which is a great segue into the next thing. But the misogyny of this movie really put me off too.
Okay.
Like that women, the only real female character in this movie is the stripper who came from another country to make it big because she saw Julia Roberts. And, I mean, she's truly just a blow-up doll come to life. She just exists to wear underwear and be fucked by different guys and be dumb and essentially prostitute herself for success. And I know, okay, there's me being a dick again because, no, that's the movie's commentary on the American dream, right? Like, okay, maybe, except that this is the same portrayal of a woman that has been in every Michael Bay movie, essentially.
Yeah. And also, I think that that's an interesting thing that you just said, because just because a director is maybe, like, rubbing your nose in something and saying this is a commentary on it,
right,
it doesn't mean that they should be doing that.
Right, or that it's a successful commentary.
Like, to what good does it serve? Like, all right, there's a scene where, like, Wahlberg is, like, talking to the kids in the neighborhood.
Right.
And the woman, the Victoria's Secret-esque model, like, she would be a Victoria's Secret model. She walks in with Dwayne Johnson, coked out of his mind, and Mark Wahlberg has in his speech to the kids about how he used to fuck her, but, like, now he's such a good guy that he just, like, threw her to Dwayne Johnson. And, like, what a mensch he is because of that.
Right.
And that's the type of thing that, like, you might be making fun of that in the movie, but the people who are watching this movie also include a lot of teenagers and a lot of kids. They don't need to be hearing this stuff because they're not up to the irony level yet.
But I don't even think the movie is. Like, yeah. I don't think the movie makes it to the point where the joke isn't Mark Wahlberg being ignorant. I think the movie's idea of the joke is, isn't it funny that we're passing this girl around?
You know,
which is super disturbing, and that reminded me of an even more disturbing scene when he's doing a neighborhood watch demonstration.
Oh, God.
And
I forgot about
that. He uses her as the rape victim and says, okay, who wants to rape her? And all the men in the neighborhood enthusiastically raise their hands because they all want to rape her. And he says, guys, too many hands. This isn't a gang rape. And we're rolling in the aisles with laughter at all of the rape jokes. Because isn't it funny that all these guys want to rape this woman?
Yeah, it's terrible.
Again, you can do bad taste in a movie. Like, I understand that the parameters of this movie call for bad taste. And there's things in it that I wouldn't say succeed, but, like, when it gets to some of the violent stuff later on, I'm not saying it's well handled, but, like, yeah, that's the stuff that's ugly and in bad taste, but but that works within the context of this kind of movie. But
I think it's so frustrating too, because this movie has potential if you put it with a director who knows how to treat the material.
Yes.
And it's not like, oh, it's really fitted for, like, this director or that director. You could have given it to even, like, a lot of journeyman directors, and they probably would have been able to knock it out. And
even I think in some ways, Michael Bay could have been suited for this movie. I don't know what's going to get out of his way. He obviously needs a better editor. He needs someone standing there to say, like, these things aren't funny. Get rid of this, this, and this, and this.
Yeah.
Because, again, with this cast, with his visual style, and his sort of, again, amoral view of the world, I think there's a movie. It's just so much other stuff gets in the way. Mostly Michael Bay.
I think this might segue into Dwayne Johnson, but is there anything that you liked about the movie?
Good. Funny you should ask.
Yeah.
Dwayne Johnson.
He's excellent in this movie.
And I Ed Harris, and I kind of liked his relationship with his wife, and it was just, it felt good to be with normal people every few scenes. Dwayne Johnson, and I was going to segue earlier when I talked about the pitch of the movie, where everybody's basically just bug-eyed and shouting.
Yeah.
And Dwayne Johnson does that for about the first half of the movie. He's on the same level as everyone else. And then at about the halfway point, he makes this great choice to go the complete opposite direction, and his performance becomes very low-key, and he's just sort of commenting on things in a very, like, subdued way, and it's great. He's really good in the movie.
And the thing that's interesting about that is that's the part where he's on the most drugs.
Right.
And, like, his choice is to just act like an idiot. And, like, not even more so than he was before, but he's just, like, there's one scene that I thought was really funny where they need a code to a safe.
Yeah.
And there's just this one, and it's Dwayne Johnson is so far gone that his only job is to write down a code. And, like, Mark Wahlberg is on the phone with Anthony Mackie, and, like, the woman who has the code, like, Anthony Mackie has accidentally killed her. And there's no way that they're going to get the code. And you can tell just plainly that Mark Wahlberg is completely stressed out, and he knows that this is, like, about the worst thing that could have happened. There's no way they're going to get into this safe. And Dwayne Johnson is just like, I'm all set. Just give me the code. You get the code yet? Hey, I got the pad of paper. I'm all ready to go. I can write the code down. Yeah. And it's just such a funny choice to do. And he's got a lot of those in the movie. I always perked up when I just want him to be in a movie that's worth him.
Yeah, definitely.
Because I think, and this might kind of tie into like the whole heavy action oeuvre and everything, but he might be the best action actor, I think, even including the 80s and 90s guys and the present day guys, because I think he can stretch the furthest.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
He's just so good. He's...
And his performances have gone beyond, like, when he was in, whatchamacallit, Be Cool?
Yeah.
Which was not a good movie. The joke was sort of like, isn't it funny because he's, like, a gay guy who has an afro and wants to sing. That it was sort of that Schwarzenegger approach, which is just like, we'll stick him in a role where he doesn't belong and that gets laughs. So early on, I think, the way that he sort of stretched, in quotes, was just by being stuck into a role that we didn't predict. But I think now, I think he's proven himself enough, because I thought he was fine. I mean, I thought he was good in that movie, but now I think he's proven himself that he's able to stretch and stuff that isn't just, let's cast him against type.
Yeah, and the thing is, it's funny that you brought up Be Cool, because that's like a character out of a Michael Bay movie where
he's
there to make fun of. But the thing that, it's almost like Michael Bay cannot penetrate how good of an actor The Rock is, because even in Be Cool, the thing you remember from that is, he's like a very flamboyantly gay man, but he's really happy.
Yeah, and he's very
happy and content with his choices in life.
And he's like really nice, can remember.
He's very nice. He's a sweet guy. He's like the most likable character probably in that movie.
Yes.
And in this movie, I mean, he does some terrible things and he's got like a horrible drug addiction and everything, but he's probably, with the exception of Ed Harris, like the nicest person in the movie.
Right, well, and he gets those scenes early on with Tony Shalhoub, and I kind of liked, I was not crazy about, and I like Tony Shalhoub, but I was not crazy about his performance, and part of that, I know, is the character that...
He's doing a Joe Pesci thing.
Yeah, he's playing, like, this raging asshole, and Ed Harris even says at one point, like, you're a very difficult victim, or something.
Yeah.
So they do set him up as kind of nicer than the other characters, and he's really, really good in the movie, and I wish I could say it's worth seeing just for him. I don't know that the movie makes it to that point. I'm not even saying, like, never see Pain and Gain, because I know there's a lot of people who would like it and would feel very differently. I'm sure there's people who tune into this movie's wavelength and really enjoy it. But yeah, I'm frustrated that Dwayne Johnson is so often the best thing about a movie that's maybe not great. You know, like even going back to like The Scorpion King, and I kind of like that movie, but most of the reason I like it is Dwayne Johnson. Like the movie itself is not great, and we're just constantly having to say like, the movie's not great, but The Rock is really good. You know, he's always so much fun.
Yeah, it's funny because I think back on just his body of work and I think I like Walking Tall maybe the best.
I like Walking Tall a lot, actually.
Because it's really kind of just quick and
it is.
And
yeah, it's like, hey, want to see The Rock beat people up for an hour and a half? Here it is.
It's got no second act at all.
No. But I do like that movie.
It's good.
I kind of like the rundown. There was a couple years there where I skipped a lot of his movies because I didn't see like The Game Plan or The Tooth Fairy. I caught up with Doom on cable, but really hated Doom. Yeah. I skipped Gridiron Gang. There was a run of Rock movies.
How dare you skip Gridiron
that I was not crazy about. Luckily, now he's in a movie every other month, and I'm seeing most of them, although I didn't see Snitch.
Well, then, Fast Five, that's probably his best movie.
Maybe, yeah.
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 I didn't see Snitch either. No. I talked about it once.
But I did not like G.I. Joe Retaliation, which he was in. I did not like Pain and Gain, so it's all on you, Fast and Furious 6.
Yeah. Do you think they'll stick the landing on that one?
I hope so. I hope so too. They just have to be fun.
What do you think about the whole thing with it going from Justin Lin to James Wan?
I'm not convinced that James Wan is the guy for the job.
But I'm a James Wan apologist, and okay. I have no idea like why they're going to James Wan for that.
Yeah.
It seems like a really odd fit.
Yeah, I think he's going to make not the best version of... I don't know.
I think he's going to make the one with the most jump scares.
The most clown puppets and weird marionette.
Anytime they show Vin Diesel, it's going to be like...
anything else you want to say about Pain and Gain?
This is another example of where I see a movie and I don't hate it. And then I come here and talk about it for an hour, and now I kind of hate it.
I was so frustrated by it, because again, yeah. I think there's a movie there. I mean, I know there's a movie in this story,
yeah.
But I think even with a lot of the elements they put together, I think there could have been a movie. And once again, Michael Bay is not able to get out of his own way and just make the movie, just tell the story. Like, you don't have to add all the stupid shit on top of it. I don't know who that's for. Is that for Michael Bay fans? Is that just for Michael Bay, who all the jokes are for?
Yeah, I think that another thing that I just remembered from that book, where it was this West Side Story screening, he said, you know, I take, or maybe it wasn't from the book, it might have been on IMDb, but he basically was saying that, you know, he knows that he takes a lot of shit from critics, because how could he not know that?
Right.
But the thing that he rests on is that he goes all over the world and people just come up to him and reinforce that they like what they're seeing. So we're doing everyone a disservice by continuing to see his movies.
Right.
Because that's how he measures success.
Absolutely.
But the thing, maybe this would be like another quick question for you. I don't know, and you said it at the beginning, I don't know why I keep getting drawn back to seeing his movies.
Everybody does.
And I just don't know why that's happening.
We all agree that he's terrible, and we will all go see his next movie.
Yeah. I mean, like, everybody seems to kind of almost get the good sense to stop with Adam Sandler in the past couple movies.
Yeah, maybe.
Like, That's My Boy and Jack and Jill didn't make as much money as he usually does.
Right. I'm not even considering, like, the crazy millions of Americans that go see his movies. I'm literally just talking about, like, film community sort of people who, you know, this is going to sound pretentious, like, should know better.
Yeah.
Like, we all agree that his movies aren't good. Like, if somebody loved Transformers, yeah, of course they're going to go see 2 and 3 and 4, you know. We've all agreed, like, Transformers is not good. So why do we keep going back? I don't know. I keep, for some reason... I thought Transformers was going to be different. I really did. When I saw the trailer, I was like, oh, here's a movie that Michael Bay was made for. I mean, filming cars and giant robots and spectacle, he's the guy for that job. This could be Michael Bay's wheelhouse, you know, and he Michael Bayed that movie up. And so then I didn't go see Revenge of the Fallen, but then Dark of the Moon, I think I got sucked in by, like, Chicago. I was like, well, I got to go see it because it was shot in Chicago.
I was kind of that way, too, because I did see Revenge of the Fallen in the theaters, knowing full well how bad it was supposed to be. I almost went on opening day, but then Michael Jackson died, and I was in mourning for 2 seconds. Rest in peace. But then I saw it, and I knew how bad it was supposed to be. But that didn't deter me. It actually made me more interested just to see how bad it was.
Right.
And that's like a sickness of people who are film lovers, because maybe it's just to appreciate the good, we need to know what the bad is. I don't know.
I mean, part of it is just as movie fans, you know, he makes movies that are big, that are talked about. And so sort of to be part of the cultural conversation, we feel like we should see them. He's a very important filmmaker. He makes garbage movies, but, like, he's important. He matters right now, and maybe for the wrong reasons, but, you know, as people who feel some sort of, like, responsibility to try and see as much as possible, to try and understand even the things that we don't like, we do feel compelled to go, but I'm not even going, like... Let me try and analyze why I don't like this thing. I literally go every time thinking this time it's going to be different. I'm like a guy who just doesn't learn from a girl who cheats on him. Just like, she'll take me back and she's never going to do it again.
And in this case, the girl is racist.
The girl is always racist. She's always racist.
The girl is crazy, like objectified, racist Victoria's Secret model.
Homophobic, anti-old, anti-fat. I mean, he hates everyone.
Why don't you hate Jewish people more? I keep sitting there waiting for you to make fun of me.
He hates. There's almost a Jewish joke in this movie, but not really. The joke is more at The Rock's expense than it is at Tony Shalhoub. So,
that is true.
So there you go. Good job.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks, Mike. I appreciate it.
You guys are cool now, right?
Yeah, we're good. I'll see you in Transformers 4.
And guess what? I'll probably go see it. Yeah. And here's the stupid justification I'll have for that one. Oh, it's like a reboot. This isn't going to be like the first three. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I'm going to be like, this one's different. This is like him doing the first one again. This one's going to... Different writers, different actors. He's going to take a different approach. Why would I believe that? He's never taken a different approach. Never.
I'll see it because I feel like in order to talk about it, which it's too big not to talk about... I need to see it so I can have my opinion on
which it. Is like, can I tell you, I appreciate that and respect that because I can't believe how many people shit on things. And then you say like, well, I'll never see that. Like, then you have no business talking about it.
Well, that's like all these people, all these critics are like just shitting all over Lords of Salem because they're just like, it's Rob Zombie. He's bullshit. It's like, no, he's not. And you should at least, if you feel that way after watching it, fine.
Right.
Express your opinion.
Right.
But just to like make fun of it, you're like, it's not. There's one local critic who I won't say by name, but like he's got this thing where it's always like picks, passables, and pits.
I believe I know who you're referring to.
And then they've got unpreviewed, and it always says, not for screen for critics, and we all know what that means, don't we?
Right.
And it's just like, no. Because there's a lot of examples, like, Demolition Man wasn't screened for critics, and I remember Siskel and Ebert caught up with it, like, a week later on their show, and they're like, why didn't they screen this for us? Because it actually was pretty good. We would have recommended it.
Yeah, that movie's awesome.
So... there's always a needle in a haystack,
right.
And Lords of Salem is a fucking needle in a fucking haystack.
Yeah, go see Lords of Salem, not Pain and Gain.
Yeah, yeah, I agree with you on that. You summed it up pretty much perfectly in your review for it, so I didn't
Lords of Salem
earlier. Yeah, Lords of Salem.
Thank you.
It's good, and if you want to see some good-looking Meg Foster nudity, don't watch Lords of Salem, but...
Try and find something from 1986.
I met her at a convention, and I feel awkward now, like, seeing her in that movie where I'm just like, oh, yeah, that's that person I met in person.
Yikes.
Yeah.
Someone left her out in the sun for 8 years.
Yeah. Who likes hot dogs? Because that's what it looks like.
Totally.
Yeah.
Totally. All right. Thank you for listening, everybody. We'll see you next week. I think we're doing Iron Man 3 next week. Summer kicks off. Sequels, here we come.
Mm-hmm.
Yay.
Ta-da!
Thanks, Roger Ebert.
Thank you.
Do ta-da again, I'm sorry.
Ta-da!